Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along this evening, folks, to hear Mia Freedman make her first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She's well known to all of you, so I will introduce her briefly. Mia Freedman is a journalist, social commentator and a writer, and she's the author of Mamma Mia, and down the back we've got some copies of Mamma Mia for those who want to buy it after the event, and she writes on her website mamamia.com.au. Mia Freedman also writes a weekly column for Sunday Life magazine, chairs the National Image Advisory Group, and appears regularly on the Today Show. And tonight she's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic, the changing face of female communication. Mia Freedman, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, it's become the en vogue thing to trash the internet and what it does to our brains, particularly our children and our young people's brains. Somehow the idea that a wealth of information and a world of communication is only a click away has become corrupted. We hear discussion of shortened attention spans brought about by our thoughts being confined to only 140 characters. We hear criticism, the depth of thought, introspection, and personal reflection have all but disappeared as we live our lives increasingly online and not in the real world. We are told that our appreciation of sources with integrity is being compromised as we turn instead to what is nothing more than an uneducated thought bubble on a screen. We are told that our relationships with each other have become less meaningful as they are reduced to a series of emails, Facebook shares, and Instagram likes. Parents are warned that we're raising a generation of socially awkward, socially isolated, socially uneducated, socially phobic loners who cannot read facial expressions or body language and who would rather tweet to the person on the other side of the couch than talk to them with their actual voice. Sorry, but I say bollocks to all of that. How can anyone look at the hundreds of millions of people of all ages interacting with people all over the world they would never have otherwise met and sharing advice, information and common interests and see a society that is less connected? Being disabled, geographically isolated, shy, impoverished, these are no longer barriers to connecting with other people thanks to the internet. The internet hasn't changed the way we think or what we feel. By giving us unprecedented and previously unimaginable access to information, the internet has simply changed what our brains are able to do with information and given us a new, faster, simpler method of interacting and connecting with one another. And as Bernard Keane explains in Crikey, that's what the media do and have always done. Print, the telegraph, radio, TV, they rewire humans inside their heads and in how they relate to each other, except the internet is doing it on a far bigger scale and more quickly than any previous medium. All those absurd stories about how the internet is destroying the fragile minds of our young people in the Sunday papers every week, the ones that always start a new study from, miss the point totally. They don't see the World Wide Web for the trees. Or, as British author, columnist and Twitter enthusiast Catlin Moran puts it, the sheer, awesome, exhilarating power of the internet is absolutely captivating. It is the biggest game on earth, the 21st century equivalent of the birth of rock and roll. For those who don't work in it, who are merely customers rather than Mark Zuckerberg, having access to it is like standing on a rocky ledge halfway down Victoria Falls in the middle of an all-enveloping monsoon. The roar and the spray, the constant motion and hydrating mist are intoxicating. Thousands of new things tumbling past you every second, swept into the river above in the flood, that you can just reach out and grab. Maps and shops and faces and friends from 1987 and that clip from that show that time and snowflakes and explosions and Crosby, Stills and Nash singing Hopelessly Hoping in three-part harmony as many times as you want. The internet is a mechanism for communication and not a communication in and of itself. And when it comes to ordinary Australian women, the internet is quite simply revolutionising how they interact with each other and how they formulate their thoughts, ideas, opinions, feelings, and, as I can tell you for a fact, their vote. My name is Mia Friedman, and I'm the creator and publisher of mamamia.com.au, a website that began as a one-woman blog in my living room in 2007, and has since grown to employ more than 20 staff, attract hundreds of contributors, and along with our sister site, ivillage.com.au, reach 1.2 million Australian women every month. I began my career in women's magazines and was proudly the editor-in-chief of publications including Cosmopolitan, Clio and Dolly during my 15 years in the industry. But by the end of that period, I was growing exasperated with the medium and desperate to try something else. I dipped my toes in the waters of television and ran screaming back to the shore, secure in the knowledge that I was not cut out to be a TV executive, and convinced that, as a medium, TV was as impotent as magazines when it came to keeping pace with the modern speed and style of female communication. So I fled the corporate world, took a massive income hit, and decided to start a website called Mamma Mia, inspired by years of gentle childhood teasing to the tunes of ABBA. I knew online was what I wanted to try next because, as a voracious consumer, I'd become increasingly frustrated by the nature of traditional women's media. By using a static, passive, one-way medium, it was incapable of creating the kinds of meaningful and interactive conversations women like me were beginning not just to crave, but to demand. Women's media, whether it be weekly or monthly magazines, are desperately trying to maintain their relevance within a 24-hour news cycle, which requires a responsiveness and flexibility on the part of publishers that is simply unprecedented. Take, for example, last year's announcement that Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge, was pregnant. The news broke overnight in the wee hours of Tuesday, December 4. The weekly women's gossip mags were stuffed. The first one on sale was Who Weekly, which came out 4 days later on their regular on-sale date of Friday. The other weekly mags scrambled to move their on-sale dates forward to join them, and a couple were successful, but the others weren't on sale until the following Monday, almost a full week after the news had broken. The monthly magazine editors, including the Australian Women's Weekly, to whom circulation boosters don't come any greater than a royal wedding or a baby, simply threw up their hands in frustration, essentially locked out of the story for weeks due to the strangling constrictions of their print deadlines. The fact that the Women's Weekly is the largest selling magazine in Australia is actually a liability when it comes to quick response. It takes a long time to turn around the Queen Mary. Meanwhile, at Mamma Mia, we had our first post up at 7:30 a.m, an hour after the news broke, on the Tuesday, and we updated it as more details emerged throughout the day, as did other news sites, websites and blogs. The websites for the women's magazines no doubt did the same, but due to their weekly and monthly cycles, readers don't think of going there for news. At any rate, magazine websites have always been adjuncts and afterthoughts to their main game of print. I'm told that none of the magazines saw the circulation spikes they once would have banked on with such a huge female interest news story. Yet again, they were locked out of the next chapter in the royal pregnancy story a week later, when the news broke of the tragic suicide of the nurse who'd taken a prank call from the two Australian radio hosts. This story broke in the middle of the night on a Friday, and none of the weekly magazines could touch it for a week, by which time newspapers, websites and social media had raked over it to the point where it had been thoroughly chewed up and spat out. Women in particular are voracious consumers of information, but we inhale fast and we move on. The reality is that Australian women don't live their lives in increments of months or weeks or even days. We live our life in increments of half hours, sometimes minutes, and if you're a mother of a child under two, best make that seconds. We don't wait for magazines anymore. We have information coming to us from the internet and social media much, much faster than we can ever consume it. And it's coming for free. Magazine sales are plummeting. When you pick up one from the newsagent, it's not hard to see why. That is, if you've been to a newsagent lately. Mark Fletcher, who publishes the influential industry newsagent blog, told the ABC's media report last month that 25% of newsagents are forecast to shut down in the next 2 years. The increasing insignificance of magazines is only compounded by the fact that they continue to use the same formula they always have when speaking to women. And while women's thinking has evolved, magazines haven't grown with us. Flipping through the pages of a women's magazine is like stepping back in time. Eva Wiseman of The Guardian describes it as looking down at a page and losing a decade. She writes, "The brief for a women's magazine celebrity interview requires that the writer include information about her diet, what she's wearing, and who she's going out with. Sometimes this is relevant, often it's not. But it suggests that their ideas about what a woman should be today appear more limited than ever, as if we're looking at women from a long, long way away. The subjects are often the same, relationships, work, bodies, but the women's magazine's take on them seems old-fashioned. We no longer always buy jeans to hide our pear-shaped hips. We are no longer conflicted about our sexuality or hung up on what it means to have a one-night stand. Women are no longer interested in being told how to improve their lives from on high. They're far more likely to crowdsource advice and information from websites, blogs, and social media. The online space also allows sites like Mamma Mia to be a continually evolving product. We respond to the needs and desires of our readers in real time. No decision or plan is immovable. We don't wait for 2 months before launching a new section or style of article. We don't even wait a day. If I have an idea, we can literally execute it as fast as we can type, much to the horror of my editorial team. As an editor who once had to wait a minimum of 3 months for the print publishing cycle to plod along from conception to birth of an idea, you can see the attraction towards a medium that's so responsive. Online media like Mamma Mia and iVillage are flexible to the news cycle, but also to the ever-changing and very busy nature of women's lives and interests. And the reason that formula works is because the internet and our particular style and mix of content reflects the way that real women have conversations each and every day. At Mamma Mia, we're not trying to mould the way women communicate into a package that suits the way we want to operate. Quite the opposite. We're taking the way women talk to each other already and building a website which both facilitates and enhances that conversation. If old media is about communicating information in the same way as I'm giving this speech, with you sitting there passively absorbing it, then new media is about engaging with that information, speaking with you, and then encouraging you to speak back to us and amongst yourselves and with your friends on your own terms. And this is exactly what women are about. It's what we've been hardwired to do, and it's a mode of communication that we've been practicing and refining for centuries. Elementary gender psychology, or indeed anyone who has ever been in a heterosexual relationship, will tell you that men and women communicate differently. Men will open up a conversation for a purpose, to solve a problem or to make a point, to effectively convey information that the other person will need. And that's the same way men use the internet. If they have a problem, a query or a question, they head to Google to find the answer. They hunt for information. We gather it. Women talk in a more roundabout fashion. We talk for the sake of talking, because it is often through conversation that women discover how we think or feel. We get to that point men are so eager to convey as quickly and succinctly as possible by engaging in discussion, by expressing our thoughts and opinions, and by gathering the thoughts and opinions of others. We're not necessarily looking for a solution when we open a conversation. For us, that conversation is, in and of itself, worth having because it allows us to better understand what our own position or opinion is. Are any of the blokes in the room confused yet? I know, try and stick with me. We're going to get through this together and we should have it totally sorted by this time next week, give or take a few days. This mode of gathering information can frequently lead to women thinking and speaking in a very circular fashion. One second we're talking about how hard it is to find childcare, and the next we're discussing Michelle Obama's new fringe. A single conversation between two women will move from the recent ALP polling and leadership speculation to a mutual friend's struggle with IVF, to the morality of taking paparazzi photos of a pregnant Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge, in a bikini, to the inherent sexism in the hosting of this year's Oscars, most notably the appalling We Saw Your Boobs musical number, to the tragic death of an Australian soldier in Afghanistan, and how, if you forget to do your pelvic floor exercises, it's really not advisable to join your kids on the trampoline. And that's just the first 15 minutes. And while on the surface that may seem inefficient and whiplash-inducing, only a bloke would think that. To us, It's second nature. We are hardwired to gather critical information through that conversation style. Not just factual information, but tools, tone, emotions, and feelings that will help us to shape an informed opinion. Information is a key currency for women, and sharing it bestows status. We love to give advice, and to do that, you need something to base that advice on. That means gathering information the same way our ancestors gathered berries and nuts. And the breadth of topics we're interested in is truly boundless. This is something that both mainstream media, which so often fails to connect and engage women, and so-called women's media, that is trying to stay relevant, fail to recognise. Women are interested in more than one thing. The vast majority of us do not define ourselves in only one way. We are neither Madonna nor whore. We are not a yummy mummy, or a fashionista, or a housewife, or a working mother, or a spinster. Society is obsessed with boxing women up in a way nobody ever tries to do with men. I am a mother, boss, friend, publisher, feminist, writer, daughter, journalist, sister, business owner, ABC watcher, commercial radio listener, who loves shopping and politics equally, or almost equally. I am diverse, and I am typical of a generation of women who fit no old-school marketing or media stereotype. And the internet is the perfect platform for this dynamic, flexible, and ever-changing conversation between women to occur. Why? Because the internet is all those things too. Much of Mamma Mia's power and influence stems from the fact that we don't categorise our reader or seek to cater to only a single aspect of a woman's personality. We are not a website for mums or for fashionistas or for the politically inclined. We're a website for women who are engaged in conversations about all those things. A website that recognises that women are not just interested in one thing, we're interested in everything. Our contributors range from ordinary women in the community who want to give writing a go, to professional journalists and authors, right through to Hollywood star Naomi Watts, Prime Minister Julia Gillard, opposition leader Tony Abbott, and comedian Hamish Blake. Today we received a submission from the US Secretary of State. We haven't got back to him yet. Each of those voices is relevant, each of those voices is important, and each of those voices is speaking to women through a medium that is accessible, the internet, and through a platform they trust, Mamma Mia. Unlike the more traditionally condescending forms of media aimed at women, our websites are not only a platform for women to access information in the form of interesting or entertaining opinion or stories, but actual communities where they can use and explore that information with each other. Our articles generate high numbers of clicks from readers, 1.7 million of them on Monday alone this week, and also lend themselves to being shared on social media and generating thousands of comments. It's not unusual for a Mamma Mia article to be shared on Facebook 6,000 times and commented on by more than 700 readers, reaching a potential audience in the millions every time we post, if we get it right. Countless studies show that men use the internet to get the information they need, whereas women use the internet to communicate about information they didn't even know they wanted. In fact, women are 68% more likely to use social networking or media to communicate with friends rather than in person. This shows us that the internet is not disconnecting women from real-life conversations. It's actually adding a new and deeper layer to those conversations. Women aren't talking at a lower or less engaged level when they're online. They're simply talking in a different location. So why is it that this quiet revolution in the way women are engaging with one another has gone largely unnoticed and unacknowledged by the mainstream media until now? Well, the simple fact is that Australia's highly consolidated media platforms are run almost exclusively by men. But for women, at least they should be talking to women. Why? Well, in a world where media is driven to a significant extent by the advertising dollar, women are absolutely fundamental. We are responsible for around 85% of purchasing decisions and influence close to 95%. A quick glance at the type of products advertised on Mamma Mia will show you that this is true. The companies that are coming to us aren't just trying to sell dishwashing powder and makeup. Women are the ones buying and influencing the sale of big ticket items, from health insurance to cars to holidays and banking. And yet, this incredibly lucrative market and a readership hungry for content that speaks to them in their own language continue to be dissatisfied by the offerings of the mainstream media. We're no longer speaking futuristically about the day when online news overtakes newspapers. Look behind you. That day has already come. It is not unusual for the broadsheet newspapers to be recording decreases in sales of around 5% each quarter. The rolling announcements of job losses at Fairfax and News Limited show how quickly the world is moving on from a print publication that updates itself only every 24 hours and fails to speak to women in their own language. The big players are finally looking to the online space, with Fairfax launching a women's website last year and News Limited set to do so in the coming weeks. But when we first began Mamma Mia, we were frequently told women were a niche audience, something that we found, frankly, hilarious. Suddenly, the big players have worked out that women are not only a majority of the population, we punch way above our weight when it comes to economic and political influence. They are finally recognising what media titans like the BBC, the Huffington Post, the New York Times and others around the world discovered over a decade ago, that this new platform delivers unprecedented engagement and that you have to go to where your readers are rather than expect them to come to you. Mass media and communication in Australia continues to be governed by very few voices, voices who will ultimately reach many, many ears. As such, the points of view are still very limited. The success of Mamma Mia and independent media in other parts of the world show that women are craving a different perspective. They want news and opinion that is delivered to them with a female slant, with an emotional rather than an aggressive, inflammatory or condescending entry point into each story. Not information that is dumbed down or simplified, but information that is presented in a way which garners women's personal investment and engagement with the story. The relevance of Australian women forming communities online goes far beyond the media and business spheres and reaches into the political. Globally, we've seen the power of the internet as a great social equaliser. Access to information breaks down economic, social, and cultural barriers and promotes greater understanding between individuals. But it also provides a rallying mechanism through which groups are able to form and gather together to mobilise their newfound voice, a voice that would have otherwise been a financial and physical impossibility. And we've already seen that power demonstrated loud and clear by the Mamma Mia community and other online communities of women in the past 2 years. Australian women are showing their willingness to take issue with misogynistic, sexist, or otherwise inappropriate commentary and actions of men in the public eye. Has it had an impact? Well, just ask Carl Sanderlands and Alan Jones and Gordon Ramsay and Maddie Johns. Just ask Tony Abbott. In each of these cases, the backlash against comments that were perceived as sexist has been overwhelming, and merry media hell has rained down on their heads. In each case, their shock has appeared genuine. And why wouldn't it be? This sort of public pushback just wasn't possible before. It was invisible. It's the power of online communities and social media that is giving the public, and most particularly women, the ability to speak up to the rich and influential in a way they never could previously. In the face of such extreme public anger and media castigation, some boundary pushers have understood faster than others that they've gone too far. Some remorse has been heartfelt and sincere. Other apologies have been cynical and made at gunpoint, motivated by spin doctors and a mercenary desire to secure financial earnings. Behind the scenes, I guess many remain quietly defiant, seething that they're suddenly being held accountable for things they've done freely for years. But there is no question that regardless of the personal feelings or opinions of these men, there has been a financial and societal impact felt, and it's been felt because of women. Women who previously might never have spoken to one another or discovered that they shared a similar sentiment have done so via the internet, most notably social media. I've watched the force of public opinion be stirred up and brought to bear through the comments on Mamma Mia by the shares on Facebook. Many times on Mamma Mia, we've encouraged women to take the side of science over scaremongering and stand up to the anti-vaccination lobby, for example. Late last year, we called on our readers to sign a pledge that they would back science and vaccinate their children and encourage others to do the same. And women answered that call in their thousands. The campaign was so instant and so effective that it drew the attention of the Federal Health Minister, who met with us immediately. We're seeing legislative reform afoot in New South Wales right now that will see the scurrilous and deliberately duplicitous Australian Vaccination Network, who are in fact vehemently and unscientifically anti-vaccination, forced to change their misleading name. Mamma Mia readers and other readers on social media have spoken up recently and joined the chorus of outraged Australians who are offended by the candidates for Bob Katter's Australia Party and their homophobic position on school teachers. Again, through online communities and social media, a story and a concerned response are generated much faster than they ever could be by mere word of mouth. The 24-hour news cycle, the speed of internet communication, and an effective campaign means that the public have unprecedented power to tell community and political leaders when we do or don't like something, in real time, really loudly. The online group Destroy the Joint, named after Alan Jones' famous phrase in reference to women in political power, are making their presence felt as well. While only a small community of women, they are using social media to great effect to bring about awareness and a change of attitudes when it comes to sexist language being used in the public domain. Not since the women's electoral lobby in the 70s has Australia had a successful, organised, well-funded women's lobby. Who knows? Perhaps this is the beginning of one. Sure, this is a different kind of activism to joining a political party or attending a protest where one marches through the streets waving a banner. My proudly feminist No Nukes mother dragged me along to enough of those in the 80s, so I know what I'm talking about here. But is it any less worthy? Is it any less effective? The simple answer is no. Whether you like it or not, clicktivism has become a powerful political force. In fact, this kind of armchair activism that involves little more than a click of a mouse and the tapping of a few buttons on a keyboard has a monumental impact. Why? Because it is allowing women, whose time has previously been occupied by juggling endlessly busy schedules of work and motherhood, to engage and use our powers as consumers to make a political point. We may not have the time to organise or attend a rally, but watch us mobilise our online network in seconds. By refusing to buy products that advertise with Kyle Sandilands or Alan Jones, by sharing a meme on Facebook in support of more affordable childcare, by supporting women's clothing brands that agree to only use healthy weight models, by retweeting a message about maintaining a woman's right to control what happens with her own body, women are using the internet to remake Australian society as they wish it to be. While elements of the mainstream media are finally starting to take notice of this quiet online revolution of women, there is still a long way to go. I know I am often dismissed as an angry feminist shouting from the sidelines. That's when I'm not being dismissed as a mummy blogger, or as one male journalist at the Australian Financial Review takes perverted pride in referring to me as a penis blogger. I don't even know what that means, but he does it every single time he refers to me in his column. Condescending sexist terms like penis blogger and indeed mummy blogger are currently being used every day to dismiss women as a media market that are outside the mainstream, who aren't to be taken seriously. Dr. Karen Brooks explains, the term mummy blogger manages to keep these women on the margins of culture and forces them to be viewed as non-threatening to mainstream opinion makers. It erects boundaries and keeps them on the outside as mummies who gossip and play where the big boys and girls dare to tread. Kate Eltham, CEO of the Queensland Women's Writers' Centre, agrees. She says, if you're a male writer who blogs, then you're a social commentator. If you're a woman writer who blogs, you're a mummy blogger, whether you're a mother or not. And if you're a woman who writes about motherhood, whether in a blog or anywhere else, applying the term mummy blogger to what you do undermines all the significance of your artistic and intellectual contribution. There was much derision of Prime Minister Julia Gillard's invitation last year to a number of women bloggers and journalists to meet with her at Kirribilli House. Now, the majority of these women run websites that don't reach anything like the numbers that a daily metropolitan newspaper does. So why would they attract the Prime Minister's interest, commentators wondered. Well, I believe they did so for three reasons. Firstly, the Prime Minister and her government have been struggling to make inroads with the mainstream media. They're not so much fighting an uphill battle, but rather climbing up Everest with only a pair of Ugg boots and a jelly bean to warm and sustain them. So instead of focusing solely on that unwinnable fight, the Prime Minister's chief strategist decided to try something different. Why not try to speak directly to voters in a setting where they feel comfortable and through a voice they already trust? A blogger. There seemed to be widespread incredulity from the mainstream media that any politician would bother to engage with any form of media that wasn't classed as a serious news organisation. Well, here's a newsflash for you. Politicians are not only elected to represent those who watch The Insiders and 7:30. Newspaper readers and AM talkback listeners aren't the only ones who vote. Smart politicians from all political parties have worked out that the most effective way to engage with the highly influential female demographic is, wait for it, by talking directly to them online. Secondly, although the majority of these women's blogs reach only a scattering of women, all big things start small. Mamma Mia began as a lounge room blog where I wrote 100% of the content myself and made a couple of dollars a year on Google ads. Thirdly, the Prime Minister reached out to women writers because she recognises that she can and should be doing better when it comes to the women's vote. Abbott is a leader that, rightly or wrongly, many women have serious anxieties about in terms of how the decisions he would make as Prime Minister would affect us. Communications Director John McTiernan wrote for The Guardian in 2010, and he was right, that women are probably the key swing group in the forthcoming election, and nothing's changed. And this is because women self-organise into communities, online and offline, and we discuss our political views at length. We share information, we share our opinions, we listen, and we influence those around us. I know I've spoken at length today, and the very nature of a 30-minute address means that the audience will probably forget the vast majority of it before they even leave the room. But if I can leave you with one single takeaway from this evening, it would be this. Women are 51% of the Australian population. We wield the vast majority of this country's buying power. We are engaging and organising online in an authentic and honest way that is allowing us to use that power to great effect. We're a political force to be reckoned with, and I have absolutely no doubt women will decide the outcome of the September 14 election. Women are not a niche. And as the biggest and most influential independent women's media outlet in the country, Mamma Mia will be right there with them, bringing women together, broadening their knowledge base, fueling their debates, and taking our rightful place as a serious player in the Australian media market. Not bad for a bunch of penis bloggers. Thank you.
There you go, Jo Ashton. Thanks to King and Wood and Mellisons for the use of this facility this evening. Now, Anne down the back's got some copies of Mia Friedman's books, Mamma Mia and Mia Culpa. And I'm sure our speaker would be happy to sign copies after the event. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, but perhaps a bit earlier. So we've got plenty of time. I'll lead off. I mean, I have to confess, the speaker was right. I've got absolutely no idea what she was talking about. But I'm pretty confident within a week and 2 days I already know. I'm a sort of a slow listener. I was watching... we just come up here and talk to the end of the room like you would before. I was watching Sky News last week, I think it was, and Helen McCabe was on, and I think she said, it was Paul Murray Live, I think, and she made a comment that Women's Weekly sells still a very large number of print copies, and I think it's also got an online site as well. You yourself, you write a weekly column for a newspaper.
Not anymore.
You've dropped that.
Yeah, interestingly, they sacked me. Because they perceived us to be a threat to their digital interests.
So you're a threat. But you write for HarperCollins.
Not anymore.
Which is print. It's a book.
Yeah, I'm completely.
Okay, we won't sell those down the back.
No, we can, but they're a couple of years old. So, no, I'm completely. Now that my column no longer appears in the newspaper, my print career is certainly at this stage finished. I've really cut ties with all print media.
Okay, so.
I'll still sign books, though.
There you are. So she still believes in print, provided it's your print. So what about Helen McCain's point that Women's Weekly still sells a lot of copies?
Yeah, absolutely. But it sells, you know, less than half the copies that it did sell. Because, and the other thing is that with this idea of sharing, you know, when I was a magazine editor, we used to get so excited by readership figures because you had paid circulation and then you had readership. So your paid circulation might be 100,000 copies. And then your readership, which is the number that you throw around when you say how many readers you've got, might be a ratio of 1 to 3. So it might be 300,000. And that was if you were doing really well. Usually it was a little under double. And it showed that every magazine was shared by approximately 1.5 or 2 people. So I might read something in a doctor's surgery and someone else might read it, or I might pass along a magazine to a friend or a sister. With online, you can share, with the click of a button, you can share an article with everyone in your social network in 1 second. So that's how, when we have 15,000 shares on a post, you multiply that by the average person having about 250 Facebook friends, and you can see how the scalability online really taps into the way women share and the way women consume information. And the other thing is that is the cost. I mean, you know, the idea of paying for content now, even if it's in print, is anathema to most people. You know, it's like someone saying you've got to pay for oxygen. If there's more oxygen than you can use, imagine if someone suddenly said you had to start paying for it. Yes.
Me, Brett Sprague. I've been a big fan for probably at least 5 years.
Thank you. Where were you before that?
I think partly recommended you to politicians, and I believe Tony Abbott's met with you and all.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm interested in what you think marginal politicians can do in your space leading into the election.
I think they can engage. You know, do you mean politicians in marginal seats or politicians that aren't leaders?
Yes, the ones that aren't leaders.
Yes. We have shadow ministers. Joe Hockey wrote a fantastic post for us. Interestingly, a lot of communicating with women is about being human. So I was having a conversation with Joe Hockey socially, and he was talking about, we have this conversation every time I see him, about how difficult he finds it to go back to Canberra at the end, leave his young family. And I said, Joe, write it. You know, so much this conversation about work-life balance is directed at women. That's an incredibly valid point. And that's not to say the things that he has to say about the Treasury aren't interesting as well. But, you know, it's human first, politician second. And I think that because Tony Abbott has been so wary of that, and as has Julia Gillard in many ways, I think that that's really contributed to a suspicion probably around both of them in the electorate. Because whether you like it or not, we want to know a little bit about who our politicians are, you know, who we're entrusting to make the decisions. So we are often approached by backbenchers, you know, ministers, shadow ministers, to write about their portfolios or to write about other things. So the more you can engage online, the better. It's not just about doing a spread in Women's Weekly anymore or going on 7:30.
We'll go here, then we'll go down the back.
Mia,
Hi.
Hi, Jennifer Durante from the Cerebral Palsy Alliance. We know that women talk, women advocate, and women communicate. And we are in a space where we're trying to get women to talk with each other about new preventers of cerebral palsy, which is really exciting for young mothers and families. You talk about this collectivism. Do you think that's at a stage now where women are empowered enough to be able to spread the word, spread the message, to the point where it can change public health policy?
Absolutely.
So that women are offered this treatment.
Absolutely.
Not say it's not traditional
yes,
treatment.
Yes. Because what I said to you about information is status, women also love to help. We love to be an authority on something. So if you say, please share this with anyone you know who might have a baby in the next 10 years or ever, they will, because it only takes one click. They don't have to photocopy something and find people's addresses and organise a meeting. They can just go click. And it's funny, you know, they talk about how you encourage people to share, because, of course, that's what everybody wants on social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is. You just ask them to. So you just say, please share this with everyone you know. And people are quite obedient, and they want to help, particularly if it's a public health message like that. We've been very effective in the work that we've done around immunisation. And women's magazines used to absolutely be a leader and have done fantastic things. For all my criticisms of magazines more recently, you know, before anyone was talking about AIDS or skin cancer prevention or breast cancer, women's magazines around things like, particularly around sexual health, that was the only place you were able to spread that kind of information and public health message. So, yeah, I think clicktivism is absolutely crucial in terms of spreading public health messages.
Question, oh, there, yeah, then, yes.
Mayor Scott Heathcote. You're obviously involved in a fascinating New Age project. I'm interested, though, in some respects, for you to unpack why you still use some old-fashioned language when you tend to clump women together as though they were a homogenous group.
Yeah.
I'm being subtle about that, but there is a nuance.
You don't have to be subtle.
I'd like you to explain the nuance of actually...
I think
talking
that,
about women as some sort of...
Of course, and of course, you know, that's what's so farcical about any conversation you have about gender. I mean, you're always going to have to make broad generalisations about men and women for the purpose of having any discussion like this. But I suppose while every woman is absolutely individual, there are certain qualities that are more typical of a gender. So, you know, in some ways we are hardwired differently. That doesn't apply to everybody, but I'm talking in a general sense. I think that that idea of dumbing down the female stereotype is the biggest mistake you can make. And I think even feminists do it as well. This idea of what you have to be a feminist, it's almost like a checklist of things you can and can't do if you're a feminist. And I think anything that tries to box women in is ultimately going to be rejected by them. Hopefully not including the speech that I've just given.
Oh, Mia, being an older woman down the back here, it's fascinating. Recently I did Facebook and I've got younger women that I know that are on there with other people. But what I found with the misogynist debate, and I cynically made my comment as it went on, was that a number of 30-something women suddenly became aware that they needed to be feminist. And it seemed to me that this was a kind of the next wave, and Anne Summers suddenly had a new set of fans and all the rest of it. But when it was all the shouting and brouhaha was finished, Ellen Jones' ratings went up. Tony Abbott is now more popular than Julia Gillard. It was a fiasco politically for females in at the top job. And as I look through Mea Culpa, and as I listen to some of the things that you're talking about, the communication's fine. You've jumped on the next way to get women talking. But we're still doing the same old thing. It's Lysistrata all over again, the sex gap in one of your chapters and so on. So when does it ever change? I mean, we communicate, but is it too much the sisterhood and not enough of women trying to cut across the gap between them and men? And maybe spend a little less time chattering and a little bit more time being considered and thinking and doing a little bit more like the men do and therefore getting beyond the gap.
I think women just do things in different ways. I suppose I'd probably take issue with the premise that the Ellen Jones thing was a debacle. I think that you say his ratings went up, I'm sure they did, because I listened to see what Ellen Jones's program might sound like without ads. The thing is that Ellen Jones has been put on notice, as has Kyle Sanderlands, that the way they were talking about women is no longer acceptable. And you can bet they've been put on notice by their management because we've been able to get them in the hip pocket. They're not doing it altruistically. We've been able to show that there's a financial consequence that comes with speaking in appalling ways about women. So I think that just looking at Alan Jones's ratings is not necessarily... an indicator of how successful that was. And I think that this idea of chattering, I just think it's not necessarily, you know, we can say what women should be doing, and we could say what we would like women to be doing, but, you know, you just have to work with what women are doing. And try, my opinion is that you try to harness that. And I've seen, you know, I'm starting to see that the fact that people even know what the word misogyny means, and we're debating what misogyny was, I think that was a fantastic thing for feminism and for women.
Yes, you've mentioned that unleashing women's power, and they have a lot of freedom nowadays, and of course also you've talked about being sort of loyalists and everything, and that they're more interested in more than one interest. My question is that the is the interest of men and women now becoming more and more common, that they share more common interests now?
Sharing
the same interests. And I don't mean that more men are reading Women Weekly, but what I'm meaning is that they're sharing more of these same goals of cost of living and so forth, that they share the same goals now.
Absolutely.
The difference between the two.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, let's be clear, every study shows that, that in Western countries, women don't vote because of the hair style of the candidate. They vote based on economic policy. And that's why this condescending old school idea of the women's pages in magazines and on a current affairs shows and you know, it's like, let's do a women's story. There aren't women's issues. There are people issues. You know, my husband's in the audience. We work together. He's the CEO of Mamma Mia. And every issue that's my issue with the family or the economy is his issue as well. And I think that's very, very typical of most families and most relationships. So I think that mainstream media, with their segregation of what they consider to be a women's issue, is condescending and really, really out of touch.
Question on the back.
Hi, Mia.
Hey.
I just want to know about trying to engage women in finance, so trying to get them to engage in better financial management. Do you know, have any ideas and suggestions on how we potentially do those kind of things?
Yeah, we've done a lot of work with finance clients because, you know, I think that they come to us knowing that we have to find an emotional entry point into every conversation. So, for example, we've just done a big series of posts with the Commonwealth Bank. And it's all about, you know, what are those emotional touch points for women around finance? Is it about teaching your children the value of money? Is it about saving? You know, we've also worked with like life insurance and talking about income protection. So what you often do is that you engage women with an emotional entry point, which might be a real person talking anecdotally about their life. It's basically finding ways to incorporate, you know, hook it on real experiences and real emotions in their life. If you just try to feed them dry, and again, I'm generalising, but in our experience, if you try to feed them very dry, straight information, it's not necessarily the most effective way to communicate.
Question up here, Yes, go on.
Mia, listening to you earlier, I was really embarrassed to hear about how men use the internet and how women do, because I'm embarrassed to say that I use it the way men do. And
there are a lot of people who do.
But it causes me to wonder, for women who are extremely work-wise, time poor, CEOs of organisations, how do you filter everything's out? How do you use your time, what little time you have, using the internet to get the information you want? What are the sort of filters out there? I mean, obviously, your blog is one way, but that's my issue. I don't know.
There's so much. People are increasingly using social media as a filter. So what they'll do is that, you know, people think of Twitter and Facebook as, you know, places to look up ex-boyfriends or read about what Britney Spears had for breakfast. And you can use them in that way if you choose. But the other way that you can use them is really as a filter. So you can follow news organisations and individual journalists or people or areas of interest that you have. And what Facebook and Twitter are very useful for is then posting links to different things. So instead of going to 200 websites, you just go to Twitter or you just go to Facebook. About 50% or more of our traffic comes from those two places. So we're there as well, going and getting that audience. And the way I kind of often explain it is that if you've got something that you're trying to promote and you're trying to attract an audience, it's a little bit like having an avocado farm and thinking that the way that you're going to sell avocados is just by having a little stand outside your farm in that country lane. If you want to really engage with people and sell avocados, you have to go down to where the people are. So you have to go down to the market where people are gathering to socialise and have coffee and buy their meat. And it's the same online. You know, it's not a case of just build it and they will come. You have to work very hard if you're a retailer or a media organisation to go out and engage with your readers actively. Yeah, it can be very overwhelming.
On the back.
Mia, did I hear you right? Did you say that I have no doubt women will dominate the outcome of the 2030 election?
Yes.
Interestingly, Tony Abbott looks like he's coming up as a speaker in the scene. When you say that, so you also said you think Tony Abbott's a threat to...
No. I said there is suspicion among some parts of the electorate and among some women that there is a great unknown about what he might do. There's just a suspicion because, and I have a good relationship with Tony Abbott myself, and I don't necessarily believe all of the rumours about what he might do and all of these misconceptions. But whether you like it or not, as I've said to Tony before, those misconceptions are out there. And until he addresses on the record what happened around RU486, what, you know, his religious views, how they may or may not impact upon health policy, upon all of those kinds of things, that suspicion is allowed to sort of grow. So I think that's a potential risk for him, one that he's looking to cauterise at the moment.
But what does he say there? Because he was health minister for 6 years and nothing happened, right? Nobody says.
He was... Oh, no, but around the RU486, he tried to influence... he tried to get involved and overturn a natural process with the AMA, and it wasn't until there was a bipartisan intervention by Emily's List that was overturned. And RU486 was allowed to come into the country. So, again, there's just some murkiness around it, and I think, rightly or wrongly, the perception is out there. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I'm saying that perception is out there.
I'll just finish up with this point here. Yeah, go on.
Just going to say on that, it looks, though, I mean, things could change, but it looks like he will be the next Prime Minister.
Absolutely, it does.
Do you think, and he could be the next Prime Minister despite being a lot less popular with women than male voters... Do you think there will be ongoing tensions
from that? I think once someone's the Prime Minister, you kind of don't have a choice. We just have who we have. And despite everybody's threats to move to Canada, I think that, you know, everyone will just get on with it.
Oh, we can do that with John Howard.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, and, you know, it's interesting, what he's doing is working. I think there's been some recent polling that's shown that he's doing much better with women now. So you've seen, like, his chief of staff has come out and you know, spoken for him about some of his beliefs around IVF and around abortion. And they've been working very, very, very hard to woo female voters and woo female opinion leaders as well.
Now, we're getting near the end. There's a question there.
Hi. You mentioned the importance of women from a marketing perspective. You may be able to sense this is a bit more of a self-interested question. But I'm interested in your opinions of how brands will be winning the hearts of women in kind of 10 years' time.
It's not 10 years' time. It's really simple. It's about authenticity. You know, I think that 10, 20 years ago, the way to sell to women was through angst, was through making us feel bad about ourselves by telling us that we had problems and inadequacies and shortcomings, and that by buying a particular product or a particular publication, we could fix all of those things that were wrong about us. And that worked really, really well until it didn't. And it stopped working in the late 90s, around the time I started editing Cosmo. And I really sensed back then, and it's only grown since then, is that women push back against that very strongly. We don't want to be told that we're inadequate anymore. And we're also very, very sick of being told to aspire to perfection. So, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow saying that she only feeds her children macrobiotic food and they're only allowed to watch television if it's in French or Spanish, that's no longer seen as something to aspire to and feel guilty about if your children aren't that. That's now seen as something to go... You know, I think that you see that celebrities, through the use of social media and products as well, it's all about dismantling that idea of being behind glass, about perfection behind glass. And the way you connect is by being authentic and about being self-deprecating and about being real. That's how you connect with women these days.
Just a marketer. Final question. You've spoken about your conversation with Tony Abbott. You mentioned that you went to...
He won't go on the record with me, though. So we've had conversations... But he will not go on the record.
So you mentioned you had the meeting with the Prime Minister. So
she will.
What is Julia Gillard saying to you? I mean, what was that meeting all about?
So she came to Mamma Mia, and she also came to iVillage. She came into the office to engage with our readers, to live blog with them. So by that I mean that our readers were encouraged to submit comments and questions about, one was about a childcare announcement, I can't remember what the other thing was, and she engaged and spoke back to them in real time. And I think that it's just, it's another part of the political puzzle in terms of, or the political strategy in terms of, it's not just about broadsheets and talkback radio anymore, it's about connecting with people in real time in the way that they want to connect, not in the way that the politician wants to push that message out. So she recognises that, you know, and Bill Shorten's done it as well, and Tony Abbott's done that, although not from our office, that's a little bit of one bridge too far for him. That idea of connecting directly with their audience. And the more politicians do that and not within the buffer of an interviewer, the more the electorate responds and the more voters, you know, are supportive of that.
Well, many thanks. I think we'll leave it there. Could I call one extra person? I'll have to call everyone. So
thank you.
Many thanks. I'll be very brief. It was great to have Mia Freedman here. She's obviously a very influential figure in the public debate in Australia and has been very successful at her various ventures over the years. As I said, there's some copies of Mia's most recent printed books, which I will never be able to understand for a week and 2 days, having the disadvantage of being male. But in a week and 2 days, I'll be much wiser than I am tonight, which won't surprise most of you. But for tonight, we've had an entertaining and informative discussion. I'm very grateful for that. Mia's given us her paper. She cut it. She was on 30 minutes tonight, which is right, but Anne will publish her paper in the Sydney Papers online in due course. The talk will be up on our blog tomorrow, and I see that Channel 648 on Foxtel and Austar's here as well. So it's been a successful night. We're very grateful, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future. In the meantime, good luck. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.